Believe me, that's the pattern of the future. One of the Hewlett boys was offended by this vision and added unwisely, There's one more thing you do for the men, Whip. What? You also sleep with their wives. Like a volcano about to build a new island, Wild Whip erupted from his chair, lunged at the Hewletts, and would have maimed the man who had insulted him had not other committee members pinioned him. That night, Micah Hale summoned Whip to his study on King Street. You must leave the islands, Whipple. But the revolution's falling apart, Whip protested. Revolutions always do, Micah replied. These poor bastards are talking of joining England or going it alone just to make a few more dollars on their labor contracts. That's all beside the point, Whipple. You're contaminating the new nation, and for the good of all, you've got to go. But I'm determined to fight this insidious idea of surrender. I'll not let this revolution... Get out, Micah thundered. I'm trying to save Hawaii, and I can't do it if you're here. You're an evil, corrupt bully, and these islands have no place for you. Go. The old man shoved Whipple from the door. So in the vital years that followed, Wild Whip traveled abroad with his Chinese Hawaiian wife, his two facial scars offsetting her crystalline beauty, and from a distance he followed the affairs of home. He was in Rio when word arrived of McKinley's election to the presidency, and he paused in his work long enough to tell Ching Ching, as he called his wife, In 2 years the islands'll join America. Thank God it's over. Shall we return for the celebrations? Ching Ching asked. No, Whip scowled. It's Uncle Micah's show. All I did was get him started. He said no more about annexation, for he was on the trail of something that was to have almost as profound an effect upon Hawaii as her union with the United States. One morning, he burst into his wife's room in their hotel in Rio de Janeiro, crying, Ching Ching, I want you to taste something. What are you doing? She laughed, for she was not yet out of bed, and he was wheeling in a small table bearing one dish, a knife, and a fork. I'm bringing you one of the most delicious things yet invented. Tuck a towel under your chin. He threw her one of his shirts and tied the sleeves about her pretty olive throat. Then, from a paper sack, he produced a large, golden, barrel-shaped pineapple. Holding it aloft by its spiny leaves, he asked, You ever see a more perfect fruit than this? Very large for a pineapple, Ching Ching remarked. Where'd you get it? More than 6 pounds. They tell me ships bring them down here regularly from French Guiana. They're called cayennes, but wait till you taste one. With a large sharp knife, Wild Whip proceeded to slice away the hard outer skin and the series of eyes. Soon a most delicious aroma filled the room, and a golden juice ran down off the tip of the knife, staining the table cover. Watch out, Whip, his wife cautioned. It's dripping. That's what makes it smell so good, he explained. With a sturdy cut across the middle of the pineapple, he laid it in half, then sliced off a perfect circle of heavy, golden, aromatic fruit. He slapped it onto the plate, handed Ching Ching a fork, and invited her to taste her first cayenne. That's heavenly, she cried, as the slightly acid juice stained her chin. Where did you say they grow? Up north. We ought to plant these in Hawaii, she suggested. I propose to, he replied. When Micah Hale was approaching 76 and was more tired than he dared admit, word reached Honolulu that in Washington the House of Representatives had finally approved annexation by a vote of 209-91. That night Micah's vigil began. For a dinner he said to his wife Malama, We have 2 more weeks to wait, and then we'll know what the Senate is going to do. Are you confident? His gracious Hawaiian wife inquired. If prayer to an understanding God is efficacious, then I am confident. The Hales ate in candlelight and sat across from each other so that verbal communication was quick and direct. Malama, in her 65th year, was stately rather than vivacious. She had not gone to flesh, as had so many of her Hawaiian sisters, and her silvery gray hair was complemented by the pale light. She retained her saucy manner of tilting her head quizzically when an idea amused her, and now she said softly, "It will be proper for Hawaii to submerge itself in America. We're a poor, weak group of islands, and anyone who had really wanted us in the last 50 years could have snatched us. It's better this way." Micah, momentarily relaxed by the good news from Congress, asked, "Do you know, Malama, how sorry I am that it had to be your husband who did the things of the last 5 years?" "It had to be somebody," she said to the erect, austere missionary. "Of all the Hawaiians, you understood most clearly," he said. "But I suppose that's to be expected. Noelani's daughter and Malama's granddaughter." At the mention of these distinguished names, he unexpectedly found tears in his eyes, and he wanted to hide his face in his hands. But Malama saw them, and if she had been sitting beside her husband, she would, Hawaiian fashion, have comforted him. But on this important night they sat apart, and only ideas sped between them, not love. Micah said, "It would have been so much better if you had been queen and not Liliuokalani. You would have understood, but she never could." "No," Malama said slowly, "it was better that we had a headstrong, volatile Hawaiian. Let the world see us dying as we actually were." "Dying?" Micah repeated in surprise. "Yes, dying," Malama said with subtle firmness. "Soon our islands will be Oriental, and there will be no place for Hawaiians." His wife's comments were strange, and Micah pointed out, "But in the Constitution we were careful to put up safeguards against the Japanese." "That's only a paper, Micah," she pointed out. "We Hawaiians know that we're being pushed over in the canoe." "You'll be protected," Micah cried. "We had an earlier constitution that was supposed to protect us," Malama said. "But it didn't prevent the sugar robbers from stealing our lands and then our country." "Malama," Micah gasped, "are you contending that only cupidity directed this revolution? Do you refuse to see the forces of American democracy at work here?" "All I can see is that when our fields were barren, no one wanted us. But when they were rich with sugar, everyone wanted us. What else can I conclude?" Micah was disturbed by the turn this conversation was taking, and he went far back into memory. "Do you recall the first time I ever saw you, in San Francisco? And I said then, before I ever saw a sugar field, Hawaii must become a part of the United States. I thought so for moral reasons, and my motivations have never changed." "Not yours, Micah, but others changed. And in the end, you were pitifully used by a gang of robbers." "Oh no, Malama. As it worked out, it was I who used them. Hawaii's going to be annexed on my terms." "It was stolen by fraud," Malama said coldly. "We poor, generous Hawaiians were abused, lied about, debased in public, and defrauded of our nation." "No," Micah protested, rising and walking around the table to be with his wife. "I would rather you did not touch me now, Micah," she said without bitterness. "What do you think I have felt when I met with my Hawaiian friends and they asked me, 'How could Micah Hale write the things he did about us?'" "What things?" Micah cried, returning disconsolately to his chair. "I never wrote anything about you." To his surprise, Malama took from her pocket, where in bitterness she had kept it until this moment should arise, a clipping from one of his major articles, and in sorrow she read it. "The indigenous citizens are for the most part illiterate, steeped in idolatry, committed to vain shows of monarchical display, and totally unsuited to govern themselves." What abominable words! "But I wasn't writing about you," he protested. "I was writing to help make these islands a part of America." "You were writing about Hawaiians," Malama said quietly. Micah, in his white suit, sat staring at the table cover brought years ago from China. He was astonished at his wife's position in this matter, and he thought of several lines of explanation that might be helpful in describing the choices he had faced. But when he looked up at her grave, accusing face, he realized that none would be of use. Therefore he said, "I am sorry if I have offended you, Malama." And she replied, "I am sorry, Micah, if I have brought up unpleasant subjects on your night of triumph. But we must not fool ourselves by words. Hawaii was stolen. Its liberties were raped." In stately manner, this daughter of the Ali'i rose, kicked her train behind her, and left the dining room. Micah, disconsolate, watched her depart, then dropped his head on the table for some minutes, after which he rose and walked to his study, where he composed a long and passionate letter of instructions to his representatives in Washington, telling them, "You must see every senator at least once a day. Tell him that the manifest destiny of America consists of an extension of God's grace to these islands. We cannot delay much longer, for the Japanese and English are beginning to make unpleasant moves, and tardiness is suicide. Plead with them. Leave no argument to chance. And if the senators from Louisiana and Colorado fight with dirty weapons, fight back. We have got to make these islands American in this session. To your hands I commit the fate of Hawaii." During the days that followed, Micah and Malama Hale avoided each other as much as possible. With each elating letter from Washington, for chances in the Senate looked increasingly good, the distance between the American missionary and the Hawaiian Ali'i grew greater, and it was borne home to Micah 1,000 times how sorrowful a thing it is to destroy a sovereignty. It was right that Hawaii become American. It was inevitable, and he was increasingly proud of his role in accomplishing this benediction. But it was also tragic, and in these last days the tragedy was greater than the joy. On July 6, 1898, the American Senate finally accepted Hawaii by a vote of 42-21. In the Senate gallery, David Hale, Micah's personal emissary to Congress, wept, and his assistant, Micah Whipple, said, "This is the beginning of America's greatness in world politics." 1 week later, on July 13th, the news reached Honolulu, and an excited sailor discharged a gun. Nerves were on edge, and some thought this might be the beginning of a counter-revolution. But soon the electrifying words swept through the city, and men ran out into the streets and embraced one another. It was a wild, joyous day, with enough noise to be heard around the globe. But Wild Whip Hawksworth in the jungles of French Guiana did not hear the news for almost 2 months. When he did, he said to Ching Ching, "Well, we're Americans at last. You feel any different?" "You may be an American," Ching Ching replied. "I'm still a Chinese. I don't think your country will ever want me." On August 12, 1898, by proclamation of President McKinley, Hawaii joined the United States. But in the islands, this happy event seemed more like a funeral than a birth. No Hawaiians appeared that day, for they mourned in secret. But a good many Americans in tight coats, brown plug hats, and patent leather shoes roamed the streets, wearing gaudy badges that showed Uncle Sam entering into matrimony with a Negro woman. The mainland manufacturers having been unable to visualize a Hawaiian, accompanied by the rubric, "This is our wedding day." Out of deference to the Hawaiians, the day's ceremonies were kept brief. Soldiers marched and sailors came ashore from an American warship. At 11:45, a distinguished group of men responsible for the revolution appeared on the grandstand, led by Micah Hale. As he took his place, he looked out upon the gathering and saw Americans, Chinese, Portuguese, and Japanese, but never a Hawaiian. When the once impressive band began the Hawaiian anthem, the gasps that came from the horns would not have done justice to a group of beginners. For one by one, the weeping Hawaiian members of the band had crept away, refusing to play the final dirge of their nation. The anthem ended in a sob, and Micah began reading, With full confidence in the honor, justice, and friendship of the American people, he had first dreamed of this day while crossing the Nebraska prairies in 1849. Now, almost half a century later, he had made it come to pass. On the platform that day, there was one Hawaiian, Malama Kanakoa Hale, for Micah had pleaded with her, "It is your duty," and as an ali'i, she had understood these words. Dressed in regal black and purple, with a flowery hat and an ivory fan, she was an imposing figure, the final symbol of her defeated race. Even when the warships boomed their salute of 21 guns, and when the flag she had loved so well came down, she had the fortitude to stare ahead. "I will not let them see me weep," she muttered to herself. But when the ceremonies were ended, a most shameful thing occurred, and to Malama it would always epitomize the indecency by which her nation had been destroyed. As the Hawaiian flag fell, an American caught it, and before he could be stopped, whisked it away to the palace cellar, where, with a pair of long shears, he cut the emblem into strips and began passing them out as souvenirs of the day. One was jammed into Micah's hand, and he looked down to see what it was. But his eyes were so strained from writing letters on behalf of Hawaii that he could not easily discern what he held, and imprudently he raised it aloft. Then he saw that it contained fragments of the 8 stripes symbolizing the islands of Hawaii and a corner of the field, and he realized what a disgraceful thing had been done to this proud flag. Hastily, he crumpled it, lest his wife see and be further offended. But as he pushed the torn cloth into his pocket, he heard from behind a cry of pain. And he turned to see that his wife had at last been forced to cover her face in shame. As the 19th century drew to a close, and as Hawaii accustomed itself to being a part of the United States, it gradually became apparent to the residents of Honolulu that in the Key family, Hawaii had another of those great, intricate Chinese units, which were destined by force of numbers alone to play an important role in the community. There was old Mrs. Key, known to the family simply as Wu Chow's auntie, now 52 years of age and bent from arduous work. There were her 5 clever sons, Asia, Europe, Africa, America, and Australia, and their 5 wives, a prolific brood with a total of 38 children and a promise of more to come. Thus, as the century ended, there were already 49 Keys in the family, many of them approaching marriageable age. In 2 more decades, the Keys would probably number more than 200. To Nyuk Tsin, who still sold pineapples and taro stem pickles through the town barefooted, her 2 baskets hanging down from her bamboo carrying stick, and her conical woven hat darting along the alleys of Chinatown, the multiplication of her offspring was gratifying indeed. And whenever on her daily huckstering trips she reached the point where Hotel Street crossed Mauna Kea in the heart of Chinatown, she felt a glow of satisfaction. Years ago, she had made a cold calculation that of her 5 sons, who shared the world among them, it would be Africa who would grow into the ablest. He had been given the education, and now, at the age of 31, he was a leader in the Chinese community. Africa Key, lawyer. The sign in gold letters said so. But what it did not say was that the building in which his office stood was also his, and that several of the stores in Chinatown belonged either to him or to his brothers. Actually, the specific title to these buildings was of little consequence, for although to outward appearances it was Asia Key who owned the profitable restaurant on Hotel Street, it was really owned by the Keys as a family. Under Nyuk Tsin's guidance, the 5 brothers had formed a combination known in Hawaii by the expressive term hui. Them Keys got a hui workin'. And it was this informal corporation, the Great Key Hui, that effectively controlled the family income. If Australia's lovely wife, the Ching girl, acquired from her family a small inheritance, it did not go to Australia or to his children. It went into the Hui. For no member of the Key family could begin to identify the benefits he himself had already drawn from the Hui. His clothes, his education, the education of his sons, his home, his start in business. All these things had been paid for by the Hui, and if he were willing to hand over everything he was to earn for the rest of his life, he could still never discharge his debt to the Hui. No one felt this obligation more than Africa. It was through the energies of his four brothers that he had received his legal education at Michigan. To maintain him in law school, they had deprived themselves. Yet they never complained, for they agreed with Nyok Tsin that the ablest of their group must be educated to help protect the rest. And Africa Key did just that. At present, the Key Hui controls seven businesses, and Africa guided each along the narrow path between conservative prudence and radical recklessness. He financed every new venture and advised when earlier ones should be liquidated. He selected which real estate to buy, what corner to lease for a store, and which mainland college the Key grandson should be sent to. For the present, he was the central brain power of a trivial Chinese empire of dirty little shops, grubby efforts to make money, and small landholdings. But it was not his intention that the Key empire should remain small. And whenever he met with his brothers, they in pigtails and Chinese dress, he shorn and in the clothes he had learned to wear at Michigan, he preached one doctrine: this Hui has got to grow. To make it do so, Africa gambled in a manner that would have pleased his father, and the Keys rarely held property for even a week before borrowing heavily on it to buy more property, on which they also borrowed as soon as possible. All the Key stores bought on credit, but obligations were carefully met as such came due. The Hui never had any cash. It always owed debts that would have staggered a Howley. And under Africa's calculating guidance, it was beginning to prosper. Nyok Tsin, pleased with the manner in which he was taking hold of business problems, did not dominate her family, except in three particulars. Every Key child had to be educated. And during the year 1900, this apparently impecunious Chinese family was preparing to send three grandsons to college in America: doctor, dentist, lawyer. And within the next decade, 14 more Keys would be ready to go. Nyok Tsin herself went barefooted in order to save money to pay mainland tuitions, and it did not matter to her if her sons' wives were forced to do the same. The sprawling family lived with terrifying frugality in order to pinch off each fugitive penny that might be saved to provide some sparkling grandson with an education. In this profound resolve, Nyok Tsin was constantly abetted by the wild-eyed Englishman Uliassutai Karakoram Blake, who enjoyed walking down from the Church of England school to visit with her in Chinese. He said, "I used to curse the Yankee threat to Hawaii, and at one time I wanted to take arms against America. But when annexation took place, I shrugged my shoulders and said, 'America's no worse than England. They're both bloody robbers, and if I can stand one, I suppose I can stand the other.'" He encouraged Nyok Tsin to educate her grandchildren to their